Hello and welcome back to another edition of Editing Aloud. And as usual in South Africa, there's absolutely nothing to talk about. So we'll try our best. Ron Darby, the Financial Mail very cruelly has Finance Minister Melusi Gigaba on its cover this week after his medium-term budget policy statement last week, saying he's shooting blanks. Yep. And in a way, the markets seem to back that up. The rand has tanked.
Yes.
The stock market's going through the roof.
Yep.
Melusi Gigaba is facing almost certain ratings downgrades come the end of the month. Does he have any policy space at all to do? Is he allowed to do anything about the predicament that not him, but Zuma and the cabal have got us into?
He had a chance last week Wednesday, right, to paint. I mean, what he did last week was just like spew it all out there. Look, things are bad. And that silence afterwards. There's no chance to like kind of give some view of how we're getting out of it, or give the country some sort of hope. I guess that what he was doing in troop was looking after December, not pissing off either the radical people in the ANC or the moderates, right? So he did nothing. So that was his last chance to do something about ratings or give some, breathe some hope into the economy. What he did there was showed absolute lack of no leadership, right? I always think about Malusi. People tell me he's going to be the next president, or in his mind is. Yeah. This was a chance to show that here I'm leading. And what he did last week was no leadership at all. He just basically sat on the fence and did nothing really.
But Tim, what could he possibly have said that would have been credible as a response to the crisis? That would have been not only credible in the markets, but politically possible.
Well, the politically possible thing is the tricky part of that equation.
Yes, of course,
I think he could have been firmer on. First of all, the whole idea of this budget should have been to absolutely not break any of the fiscal stability measures that had been before.
Yeah,
and he did. He did because they had to put their hands in their pockets and dish out another, billions for the SOEs. So one of the things that he could have done is he could have insisted on the sale of the Telkom stake in order to not break those barriers.
Yeah.
Which subsequently, weirdly, after the budget, he's now come back and said, that they are going to go ahead and sell a big chunk of the Telkom in order to try and, keep those. The second thing I think he could have done is he could have been a little bit less. He could have pushed a bit harder on keeping the public sector wage bill in check. There was a lot of data in the documents which shows that the public sector wage bill is completely out of control.
Yeah.
People in the public sector are now in the middle bracket. People are earning 2.5 times what they get in the
private sector.
I mean, it's just extraordinary, and I think he could have taken that further, and I think that the markets would have liked that more because it would have shown a little bit more kind of resolve.
But how do you do this? How do you do this, Ray? I mean, if you're the finance minister, can you stand up and outright contradict the president? In other words, he would have gone to cabinet. He would have said, "This is what we want to say in the mini budget. We're going to freeze this. We're going to cut this. We're going to cut that." And they all said, "No, you can't." Can you get up in Parliament nonetheless and say, "Yeah, we are going to do this"?
Not really, not without Cabinet's backing, because then it'll just be undermined. I mean, I think this, this is illustrates the subtle but absolutely important change that occurred, not just between people when Gordhan left and Gigaba moved in, but in how the finance ministry ranks. You know, it is now subordinate to the political agenda of the president and the party. So Gordhan would have gone to cabinet and said, "Listen, here's the bad news. We are cutting here, we're cutting there. This is what we're doing. No more of that. Expenditure is going to be reined in."
Yeah.
And cabinet would have grinned and borne it because he was the finance minister, and the tradition was for 20 years, and even before that, in fact, that the finance minister actually called the shots.
So is this a demonstration of how little clout he has politically?
Exactly.
Or is it?
So he went into cabinet, they all looked at him and said, "We've got a party congress coming up. Just forget about it. Not going to happen."
And Hillary, we don't want to make too much of the rating agencies, but they do decide on how much our debt costs, and we borrow every week, don't we? I mean, we borrow tens of billions of rands per week to pay our debts, largely. If you're a Gigaba now and you can't do any of the things that need to be done, do you just pretend that you are serious, or are there little sneaky things that you can still do before? I think S&P and Moody's rate us again on the 24th of November. What does he do between now and then?
Peter, I fear he has quite fundamentally missed his chance, and it's not that there was nothing he could do. I presume it must be either extreme arrogance on his part or a total lack of understanding of what markets or rating agencies expected, because there were at least two polar opposite options which he had last week, which he could have followed, and many variations in between. The one which he may have not had cabinet approval for was to say, we are sticking to the path of fiscal consolidation. That means we are going to have to cut spending quite dramatically, and we are going to have to hike taxes, including sorting out SARS so that we stop the slide in tax compliance. And that's what we have to do, and it's going to take its toll, but we need to prevent a ratings downgrade. At the other end, he could have said, and it would have been a perfectly plausible line, here is the truth. We considered a number of options for what we might do in terms of trying to stay on the path of fiscal consolidation, but the toll it would take on the economy is just too great. There are limits to what fiscal policy can do to save this economy, and we are going to push hard from our side to make sure that the structural reforms to improve growth happen. So he could have spun any of those stories, and he spun none of them. He just sat there like a sort of a rabbit in the headlights.
Yeah. Well, that's not completely... I mean, I agree, in sort of broad principle, but he did throw in one little curved ball, and that was about nuclear. So he definitively said that nuclear was not going to happen. So presumably that was contrary to what the president wanted.
But he didn't say it in his budget speech. He said it at breakfast the next day.
Yes.
When it,
No, he did say it in the...
No, he quoted the president.
But then he didn't explicitly say that we're going to cancel the next
The other curveball, you could argue, I'm just, hypothetically, you could say that the very fact that he was speaking so explicitly about how bad the situation was wouldn't have been endorsed by cabinet. Cabinet would have wanted him, presumably, to say, well, things are going to be okay. They're a little bit, that would have been the
problem. No, I disagree with that. I mean, cabinet, when it comes Gordhan faced this in 2009, right, the same scenarios, and it was very desperate at that time. But even then, in his budget speech, yes, there was this, you have to sell this idea that, look, there's a plan to get the country out of it. And he just literally came there and just threw it out there, this is it, and sat back and thought he was being strong. I think in his head, I'm being strong, I'm showing, by being frank, was strength. But
do you think he was surprised by the reaction?
I think he had no idea.
He thought he was just being frank, and I'm telling the truth. He had months to, the point about a budget speech is it's your big outing. You have months to prepare. You have this highly skilled treasury team, which has done many
budgets. But him being surprised,
he could have advised had he asked.
Him being surprised is almost the most frightening thing.
Does
he know what he's saying? It tells you, does he know what he's actually saying? Right. Yeah. That's the whole surprise. Do you know what you're saying? Right?
And now he has. Do you think he was surprised by Jacques Posner's book on the president and the fact that he is now, whether he likes it or not, going to become drawn into a debate about whether the president has paid all his taxes, and if he hasn't, what is he, the finance minister's nominal head of the SARS, going to do about it? Tim?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the big headline of the budget was the enormous revenue miss. The expenditures basically stayed the same. They missed the revenue target by 50 billion rand. I mean, it's just frightening. Yeah. So what it was 30 billion last year.
So
it was 30 billion last year, right?
Yeah.
So cast your mind back. It was 30 billion last year. And then in order to fix that gap, they put up dividend tax and they put up personal taxes, right, on the very rich, right? So that was supposed to help, right? And it didn't. It made it worse.
They put up taxes again? I mean, given the ANC's proclivity for doing the same thing over and over again.
But his own budget actually says 15 billion of tax increases next year, which he didn't seem to have remembered because You wondered if he'd read the numbers. But I agree with him that this is a big miss, and it escalates in coming years. And where Jacques Poe's book really comes in is already SARS is reporting declining levels of tax compliance, and people are very worried about tax morality.
Yeah.
And Jacques Poe's book is just absolutely going to strengthen this. Why should we pay if the boss doesn't pay?
Is there Raymond is there a political fallout from the revelations in this book? Do you think?
Oh yeah, I mean I think the revelations are extraordinary. I mean you've got Glenn Agliotti, who presumably knows what a South African gangster is, saying that he's a gangster just like us, on the record. There is taped.
But is he a real gangster?
But is he a real gangster? Yeah, yeah, yeah. For that, you're going to have to read the financial market. So I think the fallout, but the tax fallout is massive. Yeah. You know, and it's not that people will now, although suddenly you have, you know, radio talk shows about should there or should there not be a tax revolt. I don't think tax revolt is.
But does it come in? Does it affect? Does it affect the December ANC conference run? Do you think this book?
I think it does. The revelations, perhaps they're planned as well, that they come out so soon towards December and so on. I think it does weaken. I'm just being hopeful. I'm hoping that it does weaken the president going into December, and people are trying to scurry away from him. But the one uncomfortable thing about the whole SARS thing, like for 5 years, they were begging our president to face up for tax. That was the problem. Trying to find a political solution.
Presumably that's why Pillay and them were fired, right?
Because
they kept on bugging him.
Yeah, they bugged him for 5 years, a political solution, and then he just had time to proper plan. And hence we have the weakest finance minister we've had in the new South Africa and so on. And a treasury actually that's at its weakest. And it all starts because of this political solution to our president's tax issue. So almost, I'm irritated by even Ivan Pillay, the whole unit itself, for trying to find a political solution with their number one. But maybe from the very beginning, they had to be like hard on him. And here we are with the weakest finance minister we've seen in the news
dispensation. I understand that it is quite normal for SARS, if they're high net worth taxpayers or big corporates who have fallen off the compliance ladder, if you like. It is quite normal to go and see them and say, would you like to talk to us about this? Or at least to approach them. Yeah. So that's what they did, and especially with someone like him. But I think it puts an extra gloss on this whole thing about the NPA and the law enforcement agencies being captured so that they're not going to, it doesn't matter how many revelations we have of dodgy stuff, nobody's being prosecuted, and the same goes for the tax. It doesn't matter how many revelations we have of people who've been insider trading, raking off commissions, fees, kickbacks. Have we seen SARS, have we seen anyone investigated by SARS? We wouldn't necessarily know this, but one suspects that SARS doesn't read the newspaper headlines and say, have we checked that this guy's paid his taxes? And I think we've had this whole institution sort of eroded so that those people who are sort of up to no good can get away with it.
But it's not only the people who are up to no good. I mean, you know, the relationship between corporates and SARS is a contest, essentially. Mm. It's a contest about legality. And it's and if you weaken SARS's ability to see through what businesses are going to do, you know, they're going to find a way to root their money through.
I clearly remember having a conversation with Pravin Gordhan. He would describe how he would go and see a Stephen Kosoff or a Laurie Dipenaar and say, come on, you know that you can cough up a bit more. And there was obviously a relationship there which allowed him to knock on the door and say that. But I don't think that relationship exists anymore.
Yeah.
No. We'll be back right after this break. Welcome back. Panel, there have been some fascinating confessions or admissions or revelations in the hearings in the National Assembly and Parliament into SOEs like Eskom and others. One of which is that this fellow, Eric Wood, who I think is now the owner of Trillion Capital, having bought it from Salim Essa, is accused by the former CEO of Trillion Capital of not only knowing in advance about Zuma's plan to fire Nhlanhla Nene back in 2015, but of shorting the rand on the back of that. In other words, what he did was sell rands when the rand was relatively strong, and after the announcement, buy them back and make himself a large rand profit. That has to be the most disgusting thing I've ever heard of. But, Tim, we were talking about this before before the program began. This fellow Wood, I've never met him, comes out of the private sector. He comes out, I'm afraid, of Investec. He surely represents an ethos in the private sector that you make money where you can, when you can, as quickly as you can.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that there's lots of high fives going on among traders about getting this one right. Yeah. I mean, I think the weird thing about it is here's a person who is, bidding for work, who's working for Transnet, notionally trying to improve the infrastructure of the company, of the country, and so on, and then is so cynical that he knows that, if they change the finance minister, the rand is going to tank. So there's a way to make a quick buck out of it. I mean, I saw somebody was on Twitter this morning saying, the thing about trillion is that, the rule one about naming your company is to not make it sound like a bribe in the name.
To be fair to him, it was Salim Essa who named it. But Ron, I mean, these hearings in Parliament are also having they must be having a political effect, an effect inside the party on MPs, not only the ones in the hearings, but on the rest of the caucus as well.
Yeah, I'm sure. This is me again being hopeful, right? But yesterday's reports about Masina is that the Ekurhuleni mayor saying, look, he's not serving under Ramaphosa presidency. That's a big Zuma back already, like shrinking away from the. So that's.
How's he shrinking away from.
He's always been one of Zuma's biggest supporters within
Gauteng. But he's saying he's not going to work with Ramaphosa.
So he's stepping away, right? So he's almost giving in to the idea that Ramaphosa is likely to take this thing. So I'm seeing those as hopeful green shoots. That
we'll get to that.
The end is now, yeah?
We'll get to that. I mean, Ray and I were also having a discussion before the show where my view is that the single most powerful candidate in the race for the presidency of the ANC in December is still Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. Mm. Ray has a different view.
Yeah. I mean, I think that as soon as KwaZulu-Natal splits, which it has, it's now 50-50, 60-40, I'm not sure exactly.
KZN.
Yeah, KZN. Split between Zuma and Ramaphosa, I think her hand is substantially weaker.
And who do you have in front of the race? Because you did start, you had a nice graphic which you brought with us.
If you look through the provincial vote, Ramaphosa's stronger than ever in the Eastern Cape. He's got the Western Cape. Northern Cape is solidly behind him for what it's worth. It's very small. There's Gauteng. Limpopo, probably. So, it all starts adding up to...
And Mpumalanga?
Mpumalanga, nobody knows. Mabuza's playing a very sort of strange game. I think he's probably looking for a candidate that's going to probably in the Zweling Kiza.
So do we agree? I mean, are you? I mean, obviously it might be wishful thinking. You have to guard against it. Mm. And Ron has has reminded us a couple of times already this program. But I know business seems to think that Ramaphosa is going to win because obviously they want him to. But Tim, what's your view here? Yeah. I mean, are you.
I think they're generally speaking right. I mean, Ramaphosa's ahead. I mean, the problem is obviously who's going to win, but there's also a subsequent problem. So let's say he does win. Mm. Then what? Then what are we seeing? In some senses, you have to ask: does the party then split? Do all of the previous people break away, and or do they take the ANC with them and leave Ramaphosa? The question of what happens post the conference in the circumstances of a Ramaphosa victory. Everybody's thinking too positively about what they think that will be a great solution to the problem.
Isn't one of the disappointments that we don't know what Ramaphosa would do if he got the job?
Yes.
Why hasn't he told us yet?
Yes. Well, the question of what happens subsequently is a big issue. I'm not as convinced as everybody that Ramaphosa is going to win.
I'm not convinced at all.
NDZ's been getting around to the branches, and she's in there. And there's another question of what happens after. There's the question before anything else of whether the conference happens at all, because there is quite a strongly held theory that if it even looks like he's going to win, you can expect credentials, battles, and all sorts of things going to court, and it's quite possible that December doesn't even happen, at least not in December. So that's question number one, and then question number two is, if for the sake of argument he does win, what do we know about whether he has the resolve or the
authority
or even the plan to start really turning it around?
Because he's not really taken anybody into his confidence. I don't know whether I've not seen a single interview with Cyril Ramaphosa. Professor Zana Zuma wrote what I thought was a very plausible Peace and Business Day on your op-ed page the other day. Nothing from Ramaphosa. What's his plan? I mean, everybody's going around saying radical economic transformation, wherever you are on the spectrum.
But
why can't he say something?
But that's died down.
Talk to us, Cyril.
Radical has died down a bit, but I think what they're saying, what Ramaphosa's going to do, is the whole idea now is who is he charging? I mean, that's the big fear right now within the ANC now. But if should he win, he's saying now that he's going to go charge them. People are going to go to court, right? Are going to go to jail and so on. So everyone's asking, does he have the gumption or post when he's won to actually go through with it? That's what he's telling everyone with things. People are questioning whether does he have the stick to carry on and charge people. I mean, Jagpo's book and so on shows that lots of people need to be charged, right? Yeah. That's what he has to do, to start the whole cleanup campaign.
Well, he can't charge him. He's just got to appoint a proper policeman to run the police service and a proper prosecutor to run the prosecution.
And the thing with Tim was saying, if Zuma loses and they split and cause another party, that's great for the ANC. Jesus, can you imagine a party with Nomvula and Mokonyane on the side starting their own party? That's great for the ANC.
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. No. They'll never go anywhere. No, I don't think they just get going to jail, period, right?
You see, I think the one thing about Ramaphosa is that he's a master negotiator.
Yeah.
So he knows that his biggest card is the consequences of the whole state capture thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's not going to give that card up now. Nope. Say, I'm not charging anyone in here.
Yeah.
He's got what is his leverage within the party? Mm. He's going to hold that card out there in their noses all the way until December.
Totally. Yeah.
But that's how he's going to leave a support within the party.
But you know, people forget that this election is about the head of the ANC. You know, it's not about the head of the country. So you know, so everybody who thinks that that this is going to change things dramatically, you know, you've still got 2 years to go before the election. You know, and then only will he, if he wins, have the authority to change the prosecuting or, you know, the.
But ANC,
well, if you
ANC
that's
president,
assume, that's
your
assume
king.
It survives.
You even know. If you country president, Zuma, I mean, Mbeki, you can see in those years after he lost Polokwane, was literally
he wasn't around enough long. For 8 months.
Yeah, 8 months. In those 8 months, Mbeki was rendered useless, right? It showed you how strong Luthuli House is when there's a new president. That's what exactly everyone's worried about. The next 18 months, what will he do in that seat if he gets that seat?
Also, the theory, the confident boost on its own would start to turn things around economically. But then, of course, somebody would have to start delivering something.
There'd be an opportunity. There'd be like 100 days when people would be once again positively disposed towards what government may be doing.
The underlying challenges wouldn't go away.
So unless you took full advantage of that period, that's going
to
be...
To do things or to say things?
To do things.
Yeah.
And say the right things. Tone, right? Tone is important. Yeah. People react
because
to that,
then those
right?
100 days would fall Malusi Gigaba's or the finance, or a budget anyway.
A budget,
in February, right?
Hopefully,
what has to happen in that budget? Whoever wins, let's assume the worst. Let's assume it's Nkosazana, but I mean, you know, let's assume there's a new management in town. Malusi Gigaba keeps his job. Can he go back again? To the cabinet and say, okay, what I wanted to do last October, I still want to do. Does he get a different response?
Well, now he's had this cabinet committee of Ministers Patel, Naledi Pandor, etc., and Cyril, who've been sitting and pondering fiscal issues. Mm. So now somebody's given it some thought. So maybe he's now got something to say. Is he going to cut spending, up taxes? Are they going to go a different route? What are they going to do? Are they going to stand up to the public sector unions? Theoretically, we should have more of a plan in February, though I'm not 100% confident. But the challenges are, the economy is not really going to improve between now and February. In fact, the outcome could be worse, especially if we get a downgrade next month.
The outcome and the revenue outcome could be much worse than 50.8 billion, I presume. Is that an accurate extrapolation?
Their forecasting is usually pretty good, though we don't know. The wild card, I suppose, is that the numbers out of SARS, because SARS is not in a good state, the numbers out of SARS may not be reliable. Yeah. And they've, in the last couple of years, they've found ways to kind of vickle it at the last minute.
Yeah.
Every time they do that, it pulls revenue into this year, which is not there for next year. So you just don't know, really.
Yeah.
But it's not going to be any
talking
easier.
Talking of vickling, you've got a story in Business Day today, Hillary, on the World Bank sort of downgrading South Africa's on the ease of doing business ranking. We used to be a relatively easy place to do business. We were 74th last year, now we're 82nd, and presumably we've been higher than 74th in the past. So are we just becoming harder to do business here, or are other people becoming easier? What's happening?
It's a bit of both. And I think this is an interesting survey, actually, from a growth and jobs point of view, Peter, because this survey, the World Bank survey, looks at the ease of doing business from a sort of a regulatory point of view. So, for example, one of the findings is that in South Africa, it takes a new small entrepreneurial business 45 days, I think it is, to go through all the processes of registering the labor and registering the company and get set up and running. In 130 other countries around the world, it takes less than 20 days. In other words, less than half of what it takes here. So this really bears on the issue of entrepreneurship and small business and the fact that we just really don't have that happening.
Even though we have ministers of small business, they do nothing. For
more regulation.
I mean, I remember, Ron, when I first went to Rwanda a couple of years ago, the first thing you saw as you stepped beyond passport control was a big banner telling you it would take you 2 days to set up a business in the capital.
Mm.
I thought that was extraordinary. Mm. And it was a signal of intent that you just don't get here. Why don't we care, Tim?
Well, theoretically we do care, but I mean, somebody was talking about the difference between private equity companies and entrepreneurial companies. I think the analogy works. The same for the way that politicians see businesses in South Africa and the way that business people see the businesses.
Yeah.
You know, you see two cows in a field, the politician says, wow, I wonder how many steaks I can get out of those two cows. You know,
we are not going to listen to the story. We've all heard it before. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you next week.